89.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today on WILL AM 580, this Sunday, June 13th, 2010. No region of the world is more important, more turmoil than the Middle East. And today we're going to be talking with the author of a brand new book about the Middle East and how the United States should rethink and redo its foreign policy towards the region. Our guest will be an award-winning journalist and author. He'll be here for the full hour. His name is Stephen Kinzer. He's been on before. You're going to enjoy the show. But before we go to our guest, please sit back, relax, and listen to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey. The House Judiciary Committee went on the road this week and held a hearing in Los Angeles to hear testimony about the proposed Comcast-NBC merger. The committee examined diversity issues concerning the huge media deal that would combine the National Broadcast Network and all its subsidiaries, dozens of cable channels, local TV stations, websites, and even the Universal Movie Studio, with the nation's largest cable operator and residential broadband provider. Representative Maxine Waters of California grilled NBC about the diversity of senior staff at Comcast and NBC.
If you're telling me how many janitors you're hiring, how many clerks you're hiring, that's not good enough. We know that we can always get some numbers at that lower level. So having said that, let's just understand each other. This is about ownership. This is about programming. This is about executive management. This is about advertising.
Waters emphasized that Comcast's donations to causes and civil rights organizations were no substitute for diversity in media ownership and local competition.
And while we take this opportunity to say to Comcast, we appreciate the donations to the nonprofit organizations that has nothing to do with this competition and ownership that we're talking about today. So they should continue to give the 50 cents to the Boy Scouts. But we're talking about competition and ownership.
Waters said some people in the entertainment industry avoided the hearing for fear of being blacklisted by Comcast.
As some will note, there are a few people who are missing from the panel who were previously scheduled to attend. It is somewhat troublesome that many independent and minority programmers, producers, writers, and directors have been afraid to voice their concerns for fear of blacklisting or other forms of retaliation within their industries.
Both the House and Senate have held several hearings on the proposed merger, but it's the Federal Communications Commission and the Justice Department that must approve the deal. Waters made it clear the merger should not simply be rubber stamped.
We have worked long enough at this. We have enough self-confidence to look Comcast in the eye, NBC in the eye, and say, not this time. Not this time.
The San Francisco Public Press is a nonprofit news organization that publishes public interest reporting with the help of more than 50 professional and volunteer journalists and other nonprofit groups. Online since 2007, the San Francisco Public Press is about to launch a pilot print edition. In an era where other newspapers are shrinking in size, the Public Press print edition will be big, 22 by 14 inches, with 28 full-size broadsheet pages, mostly in color, filled with news and features, but with no paid advertising. Lila LaHood is the director of operations for the Public Press, which relies on support from foundations and individual donors.
We're trying to do public interest, civic affairs journalism, some local culture as well. A lot of our stories look at public policy and try to analyze maybe larger trends through a local lens. We do a lot of stories that focus on local civics and politics, public policy, issues that would affect a broad range of people who live and work in San Francisco.
LaHood says the Public Press has a commitment to underserved communities.
We hope to reach those audiences more with the print edition. Really, the problem isn't so much with the print newspaper. People still subscribe to print newspapers, but it's with the advertising model. And having news sponsored by advertising to support print newspapers just isn't working anymore. We're looking at print as a way to bridge the digital divide. Even in a place like San Francisco, not everyone has broadband access at home. And if print newspapers disappear, we're limiting access to news for a lot of people in San Francisco.
LaHood says they're experimenting with innovative ways to tell the news. In one feature, they've paired a comic artist and a reporter together to produce a graphic novel that will take up one full page.
We think this is going to capture a lot of attention because it's a great way to present and illustrate an important public policy story, but in a more compelling way that we think will help deliver it to a broader audience.
The print edition will start out as a quarterly. They hope to move to a weekly edition within a year. For more information about the San Francisco Public Press, go to sfpublicpress.org. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here on WILL AM 580, coming to you live today, this Sunday, June 13th, 2010. Our guest today has been on the show before. He is Stephen Kinzer, the former award-winning foreign correspondent for the New York Times and author of numerous books, including Overthrow, which we had him on the show to discuss a couple years ago when it was published. He has a new book out, Reset, Iran, Turkey, and America's Future, just published by Times Book, described by Andrew Bacevich as history with bite. I've had the privilege of reading this book, and it is all my honor to welcome Stephen Kinzer to our airwaves. Mr. Kinzer, welcome to Media Matters.
Great to be with you, and although I don't insist on being interviewed by people that have actually read my book, it's always a bonus.
Well, that's sort of the way it works on this show. One of the reasons I do the show is to have an opportunity to read a lot of books I might not have a chance to give the attention they deserve otherwise, and yours is one of the ones I've enjoyed reading. And I think this is a book that, I mean, anytime you write about the Middle East, I think it's timely. That's almost a given in view of the politics of the region. But if anything, it's even more timely given the events of the past month with the Turkish flotilla in Israel in the past couple of weeks. And so I'm really looking forward to today's program. If I can just start, though, Steve, as I understand your argument, just in a nutshell, and correct me if I'm wrong, you're effectively calling in the book for the United States to rethink its longstanding relationships with both Israel and Saudi Arabia and to sort of take a fresh look towards what sort of relationship it has had historically and should have in the future with Turkey and Iran.
Yeah, that's boiling a lot of observation and history down into a short summary.
That's what I do for a living.
That is a message that comes out of my book. Let me just enrich it in two ways. First of all, I think it's very appropriate for the United States to remain a friend and ally of Israel, but I think there's a growing fear in the United States that because of the hothouse environment of Israeli domestic politics, Israel is sometimes taking steps that actually undermine its own long-term security. Israel is not going to be able to survive forever just by its military power. So we need to think with our Israeli friends about what is a good policy that will protect that country over the long run. I do suggest in this book that Turkey and Iran, for reasons that I'm sure we'll get into in the next hour, are interesting potential partners for the United States. But I think there's even a bigger message that I'm trying to give beyond my concept for the Middle East. So I think everybody agrees that the policies we have been following in the Middle East have not worked. That's obvious just by picking up the newspaper. We have been a dominant force in that part of the world for half a century at least, and now that part of the world is a pit of violence and terror and hatred, so something hasn't worked. I'm proposing a new way to reconceive that region and America's approach to it. Other people might have some different ideas or might be able to poke holes in my idea. That's fine. I don't insist that the way I've tried to reimagine the Middle East is the one way or the only way or the real way. But what I do insist on is that we break away from our old policies and think big. We have to think now for the whole 21st century. What do we want to have in the Middle East? How are we going to get there? During the Cold War, we had a clear policy. The Cold War has been over now for more than 20 years. The strategic environment in the Middle East has changed completely in that time. Strategic threats to the United States have emerged that never existed before. In addition, there are new strategic opportunities for the U.S. in that part of the world. But our policy has not changed. Einstein famously described insanity as being doing the same thing over and over but expecting different results. That's what we're doing in the Middle East. So although I have an idea based on my years there of what might be a better policy, what I would really like to insist on even more than my idea is just the mere fact that we need a new policy. We need new big ideas and big thoughts to reset our policy for the 21st century.
And as I read the book, and I think what I really liked about the book, and readers will like about it as well, is that there are a lot of people who basically make cases similar to yours, write essays about that, and they have different perspectives. But what you do in the book, and I want to talk about right now, is you provide quite a bit of history and of Iran and Turkey in the 20th century through to the present day in particular, but also of Saudi Arabia and to a lesser extent Israel, and the U.S. relationship with all these countries. And I think that, you know, it's as I read your chapters on Iran in particular, it dawned on me just how little Americans have any idea of that country's history. And if one were to use our news media, correct me if you think I'm wrong, I think they would not learn a great deal about that country's recent history. Now, I'm not talking about the history of ancient Persia, but I mean just the last 50 years, even the last 30 years.
When I was doing some research once in the Harry Truman Presidential Library, I came across a great line from Truman that he wrote in a letter to somebody. He wrote, "The only thing new in this world is the history you didn't know." I try to take that as a kind of a motif or a challenge for my writing. You're right. I don't think Americans have much of an idea of what is Iran, and probably they don't have much of an idea of what is Turkey either. And the reason I devote about the first half of the book to try to tell some of these fascinating, turbulent stories and introduce these larger-than-life characters that have shaped modern Turkey and modern Iran is that they help people understand what I'm going to say at the very end, which is that now you understand these are the two countries in the Middle East that have had 100 years of working toward democracy. Now, the progress has not been without setbacks, and certainly Iran's regime today does not reflect that 100 years of progress toward democracy, but Iranian society remains tremendously vital. I was just there last month, and the society is percolating, vibrant, and very democratic. Turkey, which I also recently visited, is often described as the most democratic Muslim country in the world. So that's one reason why these countries make good partners for the U.S. Their societies are like ours. But the other reason is that Turkey's long-term strategic goals and Iran's long-term strategic goals are actually quite parallel to ours. That may not be true for the regime that's in power in Iran right now, but certain interests stay with states, regardless of what regime comes to power. So perhaps it's a little counter-instinctive or counter-factual, especially if all you've been reading is the daily press. But not only is Iran not fated to be our enemy forever, actually, Iran and the United States have many things in common that could provide the basis for a very positive partnership over the 21st century.
Our guest you've just been listening to is Stephen Kinzer, author of the brand new book, Reset, Iran, Turkey, and America's Future, just published by Times Books. Stephen Kinzer is the longtime award-winning former correspondent for the New York Times, now an author. He also wrote Overthrow, which he was on there to discuss with us when it came out a few years ago. This is a live show on WILL AM 580, so if you have questions or comments, the lines are open at 333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Stephen Kinzer, I had the privilege to date myself to travel to both Turkey and Iran back in the early 1970s and spend extensive time in both of those countries. And it forever changed my understanding of those countries, especially Iran, and all the political turmoil came about because, and other people I've talked about have had similar experiences, the Iranian people were the most generous, warmest people I've ever met, without question. And it was gender segregated, obviously. I dealt largely with men. But it was a much more developed society than you would have thought when I went to Tehran and spent time there. But the I wouldn't say life-changing, but it was an extraordinary experience to be in this country, which was a very rich and developed and civilized country.
People might have even a more life-changing experience or even a bigger shock to go to Iran today, because we portray Iran as this kind of backward pit of repression and ignorance. But actually, the opposite is true. Iran has one of the world's oldest civilizations. Iranians are very conscious of their history and of themselves as a people. Now, when I was just there, two things became very clear to me. First was something that I had seen during other visits, and that is the tremendous pro-American sentiment in Iran. And I travel all over the world, in friendly countries like in Europe, as well as in sort of unusual countries. And I can tell you, and I think this is probably true of most travelers, that there aren't so many places left in the world where if you stand on a street corner and stop someone and start talking and say, I'm American, people will smile and pretty soon a whole crowd will gather around you and people will say things to you like, as one Iranian woman said to me, we know they say terrible things about us over there, but we love America so much. I think that would be a little bit surprising for most Americans that this is the only country in the Middle East and the only Muslim country in the world where most people are pro-American. This is a huge strategic asset for the U.S. going forward into the future, and we should not do anything to Iran that will liquidate that asset. So that was the first thing I learned. It was just a reiteration of something I'd seen in the past. But I did have one other observation. So this time, my real interest in going to Iran was to talk to ordinary people and ask them a question that I think many Americans are asking, which is, what happened to the protest movement? So last year we were reading about all those big demonstrations after the election, and hundreds of thousands of people were on the street, but now we're not reading about that anymore. So what happened? The answer I got from just about everybody I asked was some version of this. Well, we tried that. It didn't work. They beat us, and they put us in jail. So if we try it again, they'll do the same thing to us, and we don't want that. So we are going back to living our lives. I mean, life is pretty good for most people in Iran. A possibly stolen election is not a reason to force all Iranians to charge out of their house and face policemen with guns and thugs with clubs. So we're going to have the change we want, but it's not going to come anytime soon. So I think in a country where you've got such a long history, that kind of an attitude is very understandable. America's not like that. We want change quickly. We want it right away. We want to know what's going to happen now, tomorrow. And I think observation of mine that the regime is there for a while now, at least, that's what everybody in Iran told me, presents the United States with a kind of an intriguing question. It means that if we ever want to make a deal with Iran in the next few years, this is going to be the regime we're going to have to deal with. So we have to make a difficult decision. Do we want to try to make a deal with a regime we don't like, or does the fact that we don't like that regime means that we don't want to try to make a deal?
You know, Stephen Kinzer, it's hard for me to understand the enmity towards Iran. Just this week, for example, U.S. Senator John McCain wrote a piece in the New Republic, you might have seen it, which was basically calling for us to bomb the country and overthrow the government and replace it with a government that's friendly to U.S. interests, all in the guise of liberating Iranians. And, you know, the enmity is just palpable in the public commentary of so many of our public officials towards Iran. I wonder, as I read your book and I've thought about this, how much of the Iran-U.S. hostility coming from the United States in particular is related to the relationship of Iran to Israel, which seems to be acutely difficult compared to Israel's relationships even with other Middle Eastern countries.
Well, I thought this, you're right, I think, that there's this intensifying anger at Iran. We're very, very frustrated. And, of course, President Ahmadinejad is like the Hollywood casting epitome of the dictator you love to hate. This idea that we should go in and liberate those people by standing with the democratic movement, to me, is crazy, because the democratic movement itself has not asked us to do that. They will be totally delegitimized.
You're listening to WILL AM and FM. This is Jeff Bossert with a severe weather announcement. The National Weather Service has issued a severe thunderstorm watch in effect until 7 this evening for the following areas in our, most of them, in our severe weather coverage area: Christian, Macon, McLean, Peoria, Shelby, DeWitt, Marshall, Menard, Piatt, Tazewell, Logan, Mason, Moultrie, Sangamon, and Woodford counties. Also, some counties in west central and north and south central Illinois, and one in several in west central Illinois and one in north central Illinois. That's Stark County. Again, the National Weather Service has issued a severe thunderstorm watch in effect until 7 p.m. for Christian, Macon, McLean, Shelby, DeWitt, Marshall, Menard, Piatt, Tazewell, Logan, Mason, Moultrie, Sangamon, and Woodford counties. Looking for a chance of thunderstorms this afternoon in Champaign-Urbana. Some storms possibly producing heavy rainfall with a high of 88 degrees. It's 81 degrees at 121.
All right, we're back. I think, Steve, you there?
I'm here.
Yeah, sorry about that break. As you were saying about Iran and U.S. relations, I think you were about to go to Israel, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, we're both talking about storm clouds, either literally or metaphorically.
Mm-hmm.
It's true that Israel and Iran always had a pretty warm relationship up until the Islamic Revolution of the late 1970s. Since then, of course, Iran has produced leaders, at least in these last few years, who have been very outspokenly critical of Israel. That has definitely been an added factor in the emotion that the world is feeling towards Iran. But emotion is always the enemy of sound diplomacy. Emotion's probably a bad guide for making decisions in life in general, but it's certainly a bad guide for making diplomatic decisions, because it makes you lose sight of what's actually good for you in the long run. Now, in an odd way, Israel and Iran are, at least in one sense, in a comparable position now, I think. They're the two countries that most other countries in the Middle East don't like or don't trust, and they're the two countries that lots of countries in the world mistrust and don't like. There's a lot of anti-Iran emotion coursing around the world now, and there's a lot of anti-Israel emotion. Many people would like to punish those countries. We're angry at them.
Why are other Islamic countries in the Middle East angry at Iran?
I think they see Iran as a destabilizing force. They would like to see Iran calm down and join some kind of regional security architecture in which everybody would feel safe and tensions would begin to be ratcheted down. Behind it, of course, is the Sunni-Shiite split. Most of the Muslims in the Middle East are Sunni.
Mm-hmm.
Iran is the world center of the Shiite branch of Islam, so that feeds into it. But the fact is, punishing Iran and Israel, forcing them into a corner and making them feel alone and friendless and sanctioning them and denouncing them might make people feel good, but it's not going to produce a positive result, because the stable Middle East that is our long-term goal can only be achieved with the cooperation of Israel and Iran. Rather than punishing these countries and denouncing them and pushing them away, we should be looking for ways to lure them out of their isolation, make them feel safe, calm them down, and maybe that can spread through the region.
Our guest, Stephen Kinzer, author of the new book, Reset, Iran, Turkey, and America's Future, just published by Times Books. The phone number here at Media Matters at WILL AM 580 is 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Lines are open. Let's go to our first caller right now. Line 4, Logansport, Indiana. You're on the air with Stephen Kinzer.
Hello. I wonder if you could somehow or quickly talk about this, if you're not with us, you're against us attitude. Bush certainly pushed it about, well, of Iran and stuff, and now we have fellows in Israel saying the same sort of thing. Are they playing to the right wing? Are they playing? Who in the hell are they playing to when they do those kinds of things like that? I was wondering if you'd have some information on that to help clear the air, at least from my own thinking, because it just pops up and nobody ever explains why, you know, what the ulterior motives are, whatever is going on like that. If you could give a few words on that, I'd appreciate it. I ran across this when I was in junior high school. I said some bad things about Israel in some sense, and my God, I was surprised the number of people fell in on me about that. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Stephen Kinzer?
Interesting question. I think this impulse that we have to feel this way is a it shows something that's probably deep in our character, which is that lots of other countries don't get it. They don't understand what needs to be done to resolve this crisis or that crisis. We in America get it. We understand what needs to be done. And when other countries have other ideas, they're just getting in the way of the proper solution, and they're obstructing progress towards positive goals. The idea that maybe some other countries have some ideas that are also good, and that possibly some other countries might even have ideas that are better than our ideas, including perhaps countries that have lived in that part of the world since forever, is something that's very difficult for Americans to understand. We like to think of ourselves as, to use Madeleine Albright's phrase, the indispensable nation. Everybody's just waiting for us to tell them what to do. Now, this impulse is exactly what has lays behind the friction that's developed between our old friend Turkey and us over these last few weeks. It's not just about the Gaza flotilla or Turkey's effort to make a deal with Iran to defuse the nuclear crisis. Behind all of that lies a conceptual disconnect. The Turks are essentially saying to the U.S., look, we have the same goals in the Middle East you do. We support you. We're on your side. We want to get to the same place, but we're telling you, your policies are not getting us there. You're too confrontational. You need to ratchet things down a little and listen to some advice from good friends in this area, like us, who have been here forever, who understand this part of the world, and for whom stability in the Middle East is even more important than it is for you. But the Americans are not yet on the page where they're ready to say, you know something, maybe we don't quite get the Middle East. Maybe there are some policy changes that we should make. Maybe we should listen to some other countries. Maybe others have better ideas than we do. This is not an American way of thinking.
You know, Stephen Kinzer, when I had you on the air for your last book a few years ago, one of the comments you made that was very striking to me was that the United States sort of operates in its foreign policy with the sort of conviction that a truly democratic society would only elect governments that supported U.S. policies in their region, that they go hand in hand, that a true democracy would never elect governments that were seen as anti-U.S. in their policies. And which sort of leads to the obvious point, then, how committed democracy is the United States if it's conditional upon getting the results you like, governments you like. And I thought of that as I throughout this book and throughout your comments just now, because it seems that there are democratically elected governments in the region, whether it's in the Palestinian Authority or Iran, despite whatever questions are about the most recent election. But no matter, you know, that they're democratically elected is irrelevant if the governments are seen as hostile to U.S. interests. So the U.S. is historically and through to the present day much more comfortable with regimes that are pro-U.S., even if they're not especially democratic, it seems like.
That's absolutely true. We have different standards to judge countries that are our friends than we use for countries that aren't our friends. But our advocacy of democracy, even flawed as it is what has inspired many people around the world, including Iranians. I think that's the reason that they love America. They want to have what we have, some semblance of democracy and prosperity. Now, the United States has been very reluctant to support democracy in the Middle East, particularly in the Arab world. The Arab world is the only part of the world that has been bypassed by this democratic train that's been running the last 20 years around the world. Who would have ever thought we would one day see democratic Brazil, democratic South Korea, democratic Liberia, democratic Poland? But this process has not happened in the Middle East. And part of the reason is that the U.S. is afraid that if there is democracy in Arab countries, we're going to wind up with some kind of an Islamist alternative. I think that fear is probably true.
if there's a free election in some of those countries, you're going to have a more Islamic government and one that will be less instinctively friendly to the United States than you have now. But in the long run, I see that as positive because in the first place, these movements are going to come to power sooner or later anyway, and the sooner they do, the less radical they will be. And besides that, these countries, like America and European countries, have to go through phases where they test out different kinds of government and figure out, you know, that kind of government doesn't work. We don't want that anymore. We want to try something else. As long as they don't have the chance to choose which kind of government they want, they become more radical and they decompose as societies. And that's what's happened to our partners in the Arab world.
We're going to go back to the phone lines in a second to take some more callers. So the number here again is 333-9455 or toll-free 1-800-222-9455. But I just wanted to touch on one other point before we go back to the phone lines, Steve Kinzer, which is after the Israeli attack on the flotilla a couple weeks ago, primarily Turkish flotilla, to bring aid to Gaza. I listened to a lot of the debate over it on U.S. news media, and what was striking to me was even in media that were among commentators who, by U.S. political standards, would be considered critical of Israel and somewhat supportive of the Palestinians. Even in those debates, not to mention the other debates, it's always framed in what's good for Israel. And this is what the best policy for Israel and the needs of Israel are, of course, what matters. And it struck me just sitting there thinking, if I were a Palestinian listening to this, or an Arab or a Muslim or anyone who just wasn't, you know, in the world, you'd think that like one Israeli life equals 10,000 Palestinian lives in value in U.S. policymakers' minds.
Well, there's certainly reason to believe that when you hear some of the public discourse. The fact is that there can't be a long-term solution that's good for Israel, but that's not good for the Palestinians, because that's not going to be a solution. It's the same situation that we see between the U.S. and Iran. There's not going to be one winner that can emerge from this diplomatic confrontation or whatever kind of confrontation it becomes. Any negotiation between the U.S. and Iran should be like what real negotiations should be like, if they ever happen, between Israel and the Palestinians, which is not an adversarial negotiation, but an understanding that a rising tide will lift all ships, and that stability in this region is good for everybody. We have been caught up in this conflict paradigm in the Middle East for so long that we've lost sight of the fact that stability in the region is actually going to produce benefits for everybody. Israel is not going to be able to protect itself and defend itself and assure its survival indefinitely only through military means. As time passes and demographics change that part of the world, Israel is going to be smaller and smaller. The people that are on the other side of that divide are going to be more and more. And if Israel is surrounded for the indefinite future by millions or tens of millions of people who hate Israel, that is a bigger threat to Israel than anything that can be posed as a military threat.
Our guest today on Media Matters, Steven Kinzer, the author of the new book, Reset, Iran, Turkey, and America's Future. He's also the author of other books, including Overthrow, formerly an award-winning foreign correspondent for the New York Times, who's been writing from all over the world, including Latin America, the Middle East, Asia, Europe. Let's go back to the phone lines now. Let's go first to line one, Champaign County. You're on the air.
To start with a point of fact, the flotilla was quite international. There was the one Turkish group, which was an Islamist group that has ties to some of the government in Turkey. This is my understanding, and correct that if that's wrong. But it was quite internationalist. There were people from all over the world represented. The one ship that was hit the most viciously was the one that carried the concrete and steel for reconstruction of the Gaza Strip after the attack, and even from the isolation before that. So I just wanted to clarify that, if I could.
Sure.
The point that I wanted to make, and I think one should say something about the anniversary of the election and not put it aside, because I don't think free and fair elections are common anywhere in the world at this point. The U.S. has a spotty record on its own that we don't need to waste time commenting on. But it seems to me that the representation that I've been hearing through the media is that is just taking the line, which was that this was a stolen election. And I think there's good evidence that was contemporaneous at the time that there were thieving of votes and there were manipulated areas. But it seems to me that overall, the poll cited by Mark Weisbrot, for instance, immediately prior to the election showed that there was going to be a fairly handy victory by the hardliners and Ahmadinejad. So I think that that shouldn't be dismissed. I know it's heretical, but it's an important point, it seems to me. And when one sees that, one says, well, why is that the case? And I think that there's so much not commented on. I bring it up every opportunity I have, which is that the war against Iran through proxies was full apace. It was signed on by the Democrats perhaps some few months before the midterm election and paid forward with $300-400 million worth of covert aid, which aided the Baluchis, the Jandala, the PJAC, the Kurdish groups that were fighting the Iranians. We don't like the PKK, but we like the PJAC. I'm going on and on because I think this is fundamental to the situation. I see that the Bush policy of confrontation was part of what, you know, solidified the hardliners in Iran, and it's terribly counterproductive, and I don't see any kind of dramatic change from that at all. And that I have much more, but I'll leave it at that, and thank you for the show.
Well, thank you very much. Stephen Kinzer, Iran's elections and its recent U.S. policies, your comments?
First of all, I don't think anybody really knows exactly what happened in the Iranian election. I've never written that the election was all wrong or all right. It's confused. There was a lot of evidence of manipulation. But the United States does not normally react in such an explosive way when there's a falsification of elections. Actually, one of our most important partners in the world, President Karzai in Afghanistan, has taken power after an election which was universally described as fraudulent, and the United States' attitude was, well, that was too bad. We wish that hadn't happened. But anyway, that's over now, so let's see what we can do given the situation we have. We're not doing that with Iran. One of the things that I think sometimes people miss in America is that although the repression with which the Iranian regime suppressed those post-election protests last year was quite shocking, to me, the bigger story was the fact of the protests themselves. You would never see hundreds of thousands or millions of people pouring onto the streets after a contested election in, say, Egypt.
Or the United States.
Everybody expects the election to be stolen in Egypt. Nor would they protest after national elections in Saudi Arabia, because there are no national elections in Saudi Arabia. So to me, what that confrontation showed was not just the repression of the regime, but the strong, vibrant democracy in that society. People in Iran are very used to democracy. They're very used to demanding their rights. This is nothing like a dictatorship, let's say, like Saddam Hussein's Iraq, which I also visited. That was a real one-man totalitarian state. Iran is very different. It's very vibrant. It's bubbling. It's alive. It is certainly not the state that we read about in our through the demonizing eyes of some of our reporters and politicians.
As for the Obama administration compared to the George W. Bush administration, in your view, have you discerned a difference in policy?
There's been a rhetorical change, but in substance, certainly if you take Iran as an example, there hasn't really been any change. During the Bush administration, at least during the last couple of years, our line to Iran was, you must negotiate away your nuclear program, and we will be willing to negotiate it away with you. And the Iranian attitude was, well, we're willing to negotiate, but we have other things we'd like to talk about, not just the one thing that you care about. I still believe that if we make a serious offer to Iran of negotiations in which there will be an open agenda, and both sides will be able to bring whatever they want to the table, that could be the beginnings of the way toward a breakthrough. But with the change of administration, we have not changed this policy. We are still following the policy of sanctions, confrontation, and insisting that Iran give up essentially the highest card in its diplomatic hand even before it's allowed to sit down at the game. This is not realistic.
You know, this is going to sound heretical, what I'm about to say, I guess, but You know, I imagine if you're Iran and you see massive numbers of U.S. troops in the country to your immediate east and your immediate west, and you have all these politicians saying you want to overthrow the government and bomb the crap out of it, I would think it's not an irrational. I think the Rush Limbaughs of Iran say, hey, we ought to get a nuclear weapon.
And certainly if the U.S. were ever to attack Iran in order to prevent it from getting nuclear weapons, that would then be the final proof that Iran absolutely needs a nuclear weapon. If you think you can bomb the knowledge out of the minds of Iran's nuclear scientists, that would be maybe a successful attack. But I don't know any way to do that. There are 5,000 nuclear scientists in Iran. And I'll tell you, if you're afraid now that they're going to pass their knowledge on to terrorists or other bad people, just bomb their houses and kill their children and then see how they feel.
Our guest, Steve Kinzer, author of the brand new book, Reset, Iran, Turkey, and America's Future. Let's go back to the phone lines. We have a couple of callers who have been waiting patiently, and I thank them for their patience. Let's start with line four, Chicago. You're on the air with Stephen Kinzer. Chicago, are you there?
Yes, I'm reminded of the quote you gave about President Truman before. The only thing new in the world is history that we haven't known. Similarly, Billy Graham said that he only wished he could have talked to President Bush about the facts of life of Barghani, the Sunni, Shiite, and the Kurdish, and others before they decided to embark on this thing. But apparently the soldiers of reasoning that were in place that would influence the determination to go ahead on the adventure and tragedy that we're in is based upon foreign policies that was built up a long time ago. I'm reminded of George Keenan, the American ambassador, years ago said that we have a policy that states we no longer should be concerned about the so-called normal things of human rights and other good relationships, but maintaining our standards of living and our own interests and so on. And the whole Carter administration then went on to say anything that is necessary to maintain our interests, which is considered, or anything against our interests would be considered an assault on our vital needs and so forth. So we have all these other things in place. And, of course, recently the Senator, Secretary of State Baker said we have a foreign policy that we will go to war to maintain our access to oil. So the whole world has gotten in on this matter of resources and the search and the challenge to get more and more, and we're in this bind right now because of our... So I can go on, but the part about history being learned and who influences our choices and history is so important. It's apparently the wise men have the wisdom, but others have the influence. They have the foot in the door.
I can tell what side of the divide we're on.
Thank you very much, caller, for your comment. You know, let me ask you one other thing, Stephen Kinzer, about Israel that I thought was interesting in your book. And I'll preface it by reminding you of probably something you recall or you may not, I don't know, from the 2000 presidential debates on foreign policy between Al Gore and George W. Bush. One of their three presidential debates focused on foreign policy, and the issue of the Middle East came up. And then Vice President Gore said, the role of the United States is to be the arbiter of the conflict between the Palestinians and the Israelis and between the Israelis and the Arab nations in the Middle East. And then I think in the same sentence, he went on to say, but of course, we will always support Israel no matter what. And I thought there was an incredibly ironic sentence, but the irony seemed to be lost. But what was striking in your book was reading the amount of aid the United States gives to Israel, which, you know, I'd heard figures before, but I forget the exact figures you gave, but I think it's really jaw-dropping.
It's interesting when you look back over the history of the U.S.-Israel relationship. It's generally thought of as being based mainly on shared values and principles and history. But as I point out in that book, actually Israel, along with Saudi Arabia, provided some very important covert clandestine services. Mm-hmm. To the U.S. all during the Cold War. People weren't really aware of this. I certainly wasn't. But Israel was the subcontractor for the U.S. whenever we wanted to support, say, the Contras in Nicaragua or the military dictatorship in Guatemala or the apartheid regime in South Africa. And we weren't allowed to do that because of law. Presidents would then call Israel or call Saudi Arabia and say, can you provide us with this cash? If you do, we'll give you some quid pro quo
somewhere else. The one comment I wanted to make about the caller's observations has to do with interests. All countries act on behalf of their own interests, which is fine. The Americans, however, have this kind of childlike need to pretend this isn't true. We like to pretend that only other selfish countries basely act on behalf of their own interests. But America not only would not sink so low as ever to defend our interests, but we sacrifice ourselves and our interests in order to help other oppressed people. In fact, what we should do is grow up, realize that we act on behalf of our interests, realize that this is fine, but with one caveat, and that is think clearly about what really is in our interest over the long run, and don't take steps that make you feel good emotionally for a little while, but in the long run wind up undermining your own security. That's the problem we've had too often in the world.
Let's go back to our phone lines now. Our guest is Stephen Kinzer, author of the brand new book, Reset, Iran, Turkey, and America's Future, just published by Times Book. Kinzer, of course, is the longtime award-winning foreign correspondent for the New York Times and author of many other books, including Overthrow. So now let's go back to line two. Champagne, you're on the air with Stephen Kinzer. Yeah, line two, are you there?
Yes. McChesney actually anticipated my question. How much foreign aid do we, in fact, give to Israel every year? Yes. And what are the justifications for it?
Well, if you go through my book, you'll see how the aid has risen over the years, well into the hundreds of millions per year and beyond. As for why we give it, I think the main reason is inertia. The reason we're giving Israel so much aid this year is because we gave it so much last year.
Why we give it, I think the main reason is inertia.
I'm sorry about that, Steve. We seem to have a mix-up with our... I think we'll have to hang up that caller. There's some issue there.
Okay.
Stephen, go ahead.
So because of this inertia, we tend to be assuming that every policy we followed last year still makes sense for next year. This is a big problem in our foreign policy making. We never try to start from scratch. We're always caught in this very narrow spectrum of acceptable options, and essentially they're the options that we've been using all along up to now. But if you look at the Middle East, you see that the place is a big mess, and therefore policies need to be changed. And looking at what is going to be good for the United States in the long run, we see that the biggest thing we need in the Middle East is stability. And we need to be following policies that produce that result, even if they go against what some people in Israel say is their government's view of what is actually going to produce stability.
I mean, if I can sum up what I think you're saying, and certainly what I read in the book, is that we're at a moment now in this post-Cold War era in which the U.S. connection to Israel is changing, and that it's actually the U.S. has more incentive now to pressure Israel to make a deal, or pressure those elements of Israeli society which have inordinate power that they need to make a deal.
I think you're right. There are some conflicts in the world, they call them frozen conflicts, like Cyprus and Nagorno-Karabakh. We'd like to get those solved, but if they don't get solved, no big tragedy is going to happen. But the Middle East is not like that. The Middle East crisis is really intensifying. It's getting worse and worse, and the anger and resentment that is spreading in the Middle East and that festers in so many parts of that region poses long-term threats to the West and to us. Meanwhile, the centrifuges are spinning in the nuclear program in Iran. This crisis is getting worse and worse. It is no longer an option for us just to sit by and say, let's let things unfold. We need to focus on this as a challenge and a real priority.
You know, this week or in the last week or so, this Helen Thomas flap took place. I'm sure you're familiar with it if you've been paying, watching our news media. It's gotten more attention than most coverage of Middle East issues has gotten, at least in the popular news media. And I was struck as that occurred, I was reading the section of your book, Stephen Kinzer, where I think it was Franklin Delano Roosevelt was talking with the King Saud.
Yes.
Where King Saud said this idea of turning Palestine over to the Jews was irrational or not was unfair because the Palestinians weren't responsible for European anti-Semitism. They should get it. And he was sympathetic to the Jews. He said, but they should get a chunk of Germany. That's the country that did them in.
Yeah, he said the world will shake if the Jewish state is created in Palestine, and he certainly was borne out in that. Actually, the decision of President Truman to support the creation of Israel, as I point out in my book, was the only big foreign policy decision that he took over the objection of all three of his principal foreign policy advisors. Mm-hmm. And the story of why he did that and this friend that he had who persuaded him and started weeping in the Oval Office is fascinating. So
yeah, and it's in the book, example. I should add. You write about that in the book, and I was unaware of that story until I read your book.
Yeah, I like to think that a lot of people who read my book will come away with that reaction to at least some piece of it. I always want everyone who reads my book to close it thinking that there was at least one story in there that was really interesting that I never knew before.
Well, the other country you talk about in the book we haven't mentioned really except in passing is Saudi Arabia. And Saudi Arabia, I think you point out, is a country that sort of undermines all the claims the Senator McCain's and the U.S. government makes about concern about human rights and women's rights and democracy in the region blow up. As soon as you look at this extraordinarily close ally that we bankroll, Saudi Arabia. And, you know, just talk a little bit about Saudi Arabia and our relationship with it and what Saudi society is like and what the issue is for America going forward there.
I made a trip to Saudi Arabia as I was doing my research for this book and saw what a bizarre society that is. It's really a society that has almost nothing in common with the United States, even though we consider that to be such a close ally. So it's an absolute monarchy. The country is named after a family. That's the Al Saud family. They named the country after themselves. And part of our alliance with Saudi Arabia requires us to support the absolute power of a single ruling family indefinitely. Now, the Saudi regime has two main pillars of support. One is the United States, and the other is the clergy of Wahhabi Islam, which is one of the most extremist branches of fundamentalist Islam. So the Saudis give lots of political support to the United States and lots of oil, and they buy lots of our weapons. At the same time, they're giving huge amounts of money to the Wahhabi clergy, who use that money to set up mosques and religious schools all across the Muslim world, where lost boys learn by the thousands how to chant the Quran and hate America. It was not sustainable that a regime could survive with these two pillars. One is the U.S., and the other is giving money to people who are trying to create terrorists who want to kill the United States. And there was bound to be an explosion between those two, and that's what happened on September 11th, because most of the hijackers aboard that plane were Saudis, and they were legitimate products of the Saudi society that we so vigorously support.
And we're still supporting it, though. That didn't change U.S.-Saudi relationships appreciably, did it?
You're absolutely right. That was just a kind of a little bump in the road. I actually think that although most oil in the world is sold on a kind of a fungible international market now, if distancing ourselves a little from Saudi Arabia would result in them making it more difficult for us to get their oil, that would probably be good. That would be another bonus. We need to have oil a little harder to get, and maybe that will give us the kick in the pants we need to start thinking about pulling ourselves off that addiction.
You know, but as I read your description of Saudi Arabia, too, the internal society, it really would seem, again, to someone living in the region to hear any claims by American presidents or policymakers or senators about the U.S. sending all these troops into Iraq and Afghanistan out of any concern with democracy. It would seem, frankly, ludicrous in view of its relationship with Saudi Arabia.
Well, if you want to support Saudi Arabia, you're definitely not supporting democracy. You can do one or the other, but if you want to do both together, that can't work.
Or women's rights or, you know, all the other things.
And actually, deficient as Iran is in democracy and women's rights, it's far ahead of Saudi Arabia on both scores.
And, you know, I think it's funny, it's interesting, we've been in the show now, Stephen Kinzer, talking about your new book, Reset, Iran, Turkey, and America's Future, for nearly the full hour. We've only got a few minutes left. And we haven't really had a chance to talk about the Iraq War and the Afghani War. And we just marked an anniversary of sorts, or a record, a milestone, that the United States has now been at war in Afghanistan longer than any other war we've ever engaged in, or foreign war at least. And, you know, I've talked to my students sometimes about these wars, and I almost feel like it's 1984 and we're fighting Eurasia. We're in these wars our students are divorced from. They don't even know why we're there. They don't really know anything about it. And they never seem like there's any sense they're ever going to end.
You're right. There is a disconnect in American society, and I think this is something actually quite new. It used to be, as recently as in the Vietnam period or World War II, certainly, that when the U.S. was at war, the whole U.S. was at war. Now, America is not at war. Only like half of 1% of our population is at war. That's the military.
Mm-hmm.
The rest of our society is totally untouched by all of this. And actually, that might be one of the results of abolishing the draft and having a volunteer army, because kids next door are not being drafted in ways that make you start to question whether there's any point to sending them into these wars. And I think I'm now seeing that the end of the draft and the volunteer army really does give policymakers a much freer hand, especially when combined with the fact that the declaration of war power of Congress has essentially atrophied. We no longer use that anymore. Presidents never ask the Congress to declare war anymore. Congress never does, and we just go to war anyway.
What is your sense of how those wars are going to play out in Iraq and in Afghanistan? From your knowledge of the region, I'd just be interested in your take on what we're looking at in the next 12, 18, 24 months.
Well, they're huge challenges and very, very difficult situations. Afghanistan is a place where I don't see the United States being able to master the challenges. The Afghans are the world champions, undisputed, at repelling foreign armies. They've had hundreds of years of practice doing this. And a Christian army coming from 5,000 miles away is not going to be able to impose its will on Afghanistan. As for Iraq, and to a certain degree also Afghanistan, I really believe that one of the best things we could do to try to salvage our position in Iraq would be to try to make a deal with Iran. Iran has more ability to stabilize Iraq than any other country in the world, including the United States. Many of those leaders of Iraq, who are Shiite, were living in Iran many years in exile during the Saddam dictatorship. Iran has great influence in Iraq and can stabilize Iraq. Our big fear in withdrawing from Iraq is that if we withdraw, the place is going to explode in a huge bloodbath again like it was a few years ago. And that may happen, but Iran can prevent that from happening if it has an incentive to do so. And that's why there's an even more urgent need for some kind of a global accord with Iran. It's not just the nuclear issue, but Iran has a great ability to stabilize Iraq and also a great ability to stabilize Afghanistan, as a large portion of Afghanistan used to be part of Iran right up until the 19th century. They speak the same language. So Iran is a country that, if we can somehow make a deal with it, can really help our position in the Middle East.
Stephen Kinzer has been our guest today, is our guest today. We have to go off the air shortly, but before we do, I think you're giving some talks in our neck of the woods over the next few days. Is that right?
I'm going to be in Chicago on Wednesday and Thursday. I'm speaking at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, I believe, on Wednesday night, and at the Oak Park Public Library on Thursday. So any of your Chicago listeners will be more than welcome to show up and bring their questions and their ripe fruit.
I want to thank you, Stephen Kinzer, for joining us today on Media Matters. I hear the band tuning up in the background. That means they want to clear me out of the studio. Stephen Kinzer, again, good luck with your book.
It's always a pleasure, Bob.
And I want to thank Melissa Trentz, my producer, for doing her usual great job. Kyle Krohoff for working the board. Next week, we're going to have a turn to foreign policy in another part of the world, Latin America. We'll be talking with Mark Weisbrot, the co-screenwriter of Oliver Stone's new documentary, South of the Border, about that film. And then we'll be back live with you in 2 weeks. I'm Bob McChesney. This is WILL. And thank you all very much for your support for the show.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
The National Weather Service has issued a severe thunderstorm watch for the following counties until 7 this evening: Christian, Macon, McLean, Shelby, DeWitt, Marshall, Menard, Piatt, Logan, Mason, Moultrie, and Sangamon counties. Otherwise, the forecast calls for partly sunny skies, a chance of showers and thunderstorms, some producing possibly heavy rainfall, the high 88. Showers and thunderstorms likely tonight, some possibly heavy rainfall, the low 72.